Hello, and welcome to episode 44 of Thaisi Books, news and views about Thaisi literature from the world over. I'm your host, Jenny Butt. Thank you for tuning in. Today's episode is a Thaisi Craft Chat Rewind. This is a new feature that will run from time to time when writers featured on Thaisi Books are back in the news for their terrific work. So this week, we have Dhruti Shah, who had been interviewed on episode 26, way back in April 2021. Since then, her book has gone on to win a 2021 Business Book of the Year Award in the short Business Book of the Year category. Congrats, Dhruti. Dhruti Shah is an award-winning journalist, writer, producer, and storyteller in the UK. She's written on subjects including technology, business, women changing the world, comics, science, and much more. She has a wealth of editorial experience built up first in local newspapers before jumping to global newsrooms. And she's led record-making BBC International Partnership projects. A bit about the book, Bear Markets and Beyond. It's an illustrated guide where BBC journalists Dhruti Shah and Dominic Bailey take us through the world of business jargon with a bold, graphic bestiary, as well as more familiar terms such as piggy bank, loan sharks, and rat race. There are alligator spreads, lobster traps, and even vampire squids. I so enjoyed this conversation with Dhruti about how and why this book came about and the process to get it to publication. We also talked about some of the really weird and funny terms in the book. And she was candid, funny, and inspiring. Enjoy this chat. Here she is now. Hi, Dhruti, and welcome to the Thaisi Books podcast. Thank you so much for talking with me today about your new book. And I'm really excited because it's coming out in the US. The dates changed, as you just told me a little while ago, but it is coming out in the month of April, correct?
Yes, so April the 27th, as far as I'm aware. So they had to bring more books over from the UK to the US. So that's a great thing. I'm really happy with that. So yeah, Bear Markets and Beyond, you will get it in April, or you can just get it from the UK.
Great. Let's start talking about how the idea for the book came about and how you and your co-writer, because there's a co-writer in this, I see that. And so how did you guys come about the idea for the book, and how did you come together to write it?
So I'm the writer of the book, and there is an illustrator. So Dominic Bailey is the primary illustrator, but I have done the odd illustration here and there. But you know, when you know what your skill set is, and I'm a good illustrator. I'm just not a brilliant illustrator. And I found Dominic on Instagram. So I was like, I've got an idea. So I'll go way back to tell you how it all came about, in that I was working in the BBC's business unit. I am not a business expert, and I would never proclaim myself to be like this brilliant business expert with, you know, investment background and economics background. No. I'm really good at storytelling. So I got hired to get very dry subjects, but make them relatable. But while I was there, I had a degree of false imposter syndrome, because I would be surrounded by people who knew what they were talking about, who had these degrees in economics and investments and all that. But when they would talk about things like hawks, for example, you know, the Chancellor is a hawk, or they talk about unicorns. So Facebook is a very famous unicorn. Mm-hmm. It's all in like common parlance, as it were. I would start sketching, because I wanted to try and make that sort of connect between what on earth they were talking about and things that I thought I understood. So, you know, I know what a unicorn is. Like, when you're 5 years old, you learn about unicorns. I know what a hawk is. It's a bird that's out there. But how do I understand the relationship between nature and business? And back in the day when we would be going on the commute into work, I'd be sitting there with a little notepad sketching. So I actually drew a unicorn in a hoodie, which at that point is what Mark Zuckerberg was famous for being very relaxed in his attire. So we're sort of making those connections. And then Dominic Bailey is the illustrator, the primary illustrator. And I spotted that he was doing animal pictures on Instagram back in the day when you could see what other people were up to. Mm-hmm. And so I still don't understand why he said yes. I reached out of the blue. So he does work within the BBC, much like I do, but in a different part. And we had mutual friends in common. And I just said, hi, my name's Drusy. I've got an idea. It's a strange idea, but it's an idea. And fair play to him. He got on board straight away, and he came up and he said, you know, do you know about this creature? What about this creature? And again, you know, neither of us come from this business background, but it's fun because the minute you start, you go on a rabbit hole, as it were, because, you know, you find bear markets and you find unicorns and you find grey rhinos and so much more. And I mean, I just said rabbit holes. You know, animals turn up everywhere in language, and it just made business a lot more fun. And we came up with this very simple A to Z guide that we eventually put out on the BBC. And then we thought, hold on a minute, we've got more than an A to Z. We've got many, many animals that we just can't fit in. So for several years, we just kept going and kept finding creatures and kept drawing. And it was like a side project and a side hustle. And we didn't have an agent. And some people were like, this is a really stupid idea because it's so simple. But it came out the fact that there's nothing else like it out there. And eventually we managed to find the right publisher. So it's Portico in this instance, Pavilion Books. And they took a chance on us. And now we've got this amazing book that's in like schools and libraries. And, you know, Sir David Attenborough's got a copy and you've got a copy, you know, Jenny, and you, you know, you're an amazing writer. So I'm really honoured that you've got a copy, to be perfectly frank with you. So I'm really happy. It's a dream come true.
Well, no, and that's exciting. So, you know, the project, as you said, you know, it took a few years. And what's fascinating to me as well is, now here's the thing. So I'm a certified financial planner. I used to work in Silicon Valley. I watch CNBC daily, okay? I check my stock portfolio daily. I'm familiar with a number of the terms here. Like, I know about hawks and doves and unicorns, but there are some here that I didn't know at all, like deer market and meerkat effect and chimp paradox. And so, you know, but what's interesting is, you know, you mentioned how there's so many animal terms, right? You started to realize that there's this animal theme that kept showing up in all these metaphors, idioms and phrases and terms that are used in the business world. And you know what that made me think of is when I left the business world after I turned 40, and I, one of the things I did along the way is I went and became, you know, I got certified to teach yoga. And yoga also has a lot of animal terms, right? All the poses. If you go back to the original Indian words for the poses, cobra and, you know, snake and this and that. I mean, there's like, you know, the toad, the dragonfly. And so there's a lot of, you know, animal related things. And I'm just fascinated to think how, you know, here's yoga, which is centuries old. And, you know, the people back then were using all these animal terms. And here's the business world. And here we are again with these animals. So what is it with animals? Why are we obsessed with, you know, what do you think? Why do you think the animal terminology or the animal references are so prevalent in the business world?
This is, well, it's like you say, it's not just business. It's everywhere and anywhere. So, you know, we're trying to figure out how to sort of tie it together. And we're like, well, actually, back in the day, and when I say back in the day, I mean, as in prehistoric times, you would have cave paintings. And what were they painting? What were they sketching, using natural ingredients, natural materials? They were showing pictures of creatures, you know, whether it's like pigs or horses or dogs or whatever. Humans have always been using animals and pictures of animals and conversation around animals in order to be able to communicate. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, I can't say why. I just know that it's very relatable. It's something that you can definitely think, I've got that in common with somebody else because it's a language that I understand. And one thing we have discovered, which isn't in the book so much, but as I said, the minute you start this research, you continue, mm-hmm. you find that the animals they cross boundaries, as it were. They cross country and cultural boundaries. So you would have a vulture investor, which doesn't always have the most positive meaning. So, you know, a vulture investor goes in and they look to sort of mine companies, governments, etc., in order to make a profit. So these companies might be at a very difficult situation and a vulture swoops in, as it were. But then we discover that in Germany, there is a word, and I'd have to go and double check what the word is, but it's the German word for locusts, you know, and that's being used because, you know, a locust, you have a plague of locusts. So they come in and they sweep again, they devour everything. So you've got two different words. You have the German word for locust, which I should go and triple check. And you have like the vulture investor and vulture funds, which have spread and are the English. And yet thematically, we're thinking about the same thing. So I think it's just because animals resonate. You know, who doesn't want to talk about puppies and dogs and cats? I mean, on the internet, when the internet became a thing, as it were, I mean, it's, you know, we're all digitally hygienic now, but people were talking about cats. Mm-hmm. The cats had taken over the internet. Why? Because cats are cool. I mean, they're a bit scary, but they're cool. I prefer wolves. This whole project, how it emerged, how did I make sure that I was super confident about it, bearing in mind that it come from a degree of false imposter syndrome? I'm obsessed with wolves. I love wolves. Ever since I was a kid, I read White Fang, you know, and it made lonely little me as a little girl feel part of something. And every time I had an issue, I just returned to White Fang. And so I was super happy when I discovered that there were wolves in business, because it meant that I could navigate this world that I wasn't familiar with. And I think that's, you know, I don't know if there's a wolf pose in yoga, but if there is, I'd probably be a lot more enthusiastic about it, to be perfectly frank with you.
I'll have to look that up. I don't recall, but I'll look that up and let you know. You know, you mentioned, you know, reading about White Fang as a kid, and that made me think again about another, you know, you're right, animals were everywhere. And, you know, when we were kids, it would be in fairy tales. Folk tales and fairy tales, you had the talking animals, and even now, you know, Disney movies, right? Mm-hmm. So yeah, animals are very prevalent. And I think it's maybe because they're another living species and they have behavioral, you know, aspects to them, just like human beings. And so we see some sort of way to equate, I guess, human behavior, you know, to the animal kingdom, I suppose. Could you talk a little bit about, you know, how did you choose or settle on which terms you would include in this compendium? I'm assuming that there were, you know, you mentioned the rabbit hole earlier, right? So I'm assuming there were some things you found, some truly esoteric ones that you thought, okay, we're not going to do those. But, you know, you must have had to kind of narrow down to a certain manageable number, both for yourself and for Dominic to work on.
Oh, in an ideal world, we'd have included everything. You know, the minute you find one, it gets very exciting. It is literally like going on a safari. It's like, oh my gosh, it's this creature now. Oh, but we had to be super careful, and we had to actually make sure that these words existed. That's the other thing, and that they were in use. Otherwise, we could just be dropping, you know, any old creature in. So we would... The OED, the Oxford English Dictionary, has been an incredible help in going back and sourcing first references for a lot of the creatures. You know, when I studied English at Oxford, actually, and we didn't get to go on field trips apart from one, and the one field trip we got to go on back in the day, so this is like 20 years ago, was to go to the OED offices in Oxford. And it was brilliant because it was like, you know, you would see all the index cards and stuff that people were submitting explanations for the words in the dictionary. And so that feeling that I got on that field trip many, many moons ago is no different to the feeling of finding creatures and being like, oh, we've got another one. But in terms of limiting them, bearing in mind, I mean, it's a book, and you know, you write many, you've written many amazing books, and we had an editor. And so we did actually provide a lot more to our editor, to Cara, than was kept in. One thing I didn't say earlier, but I think is probably of interest, when we were trying to find a publisher, and bearing in mind that we didn't have an agent, we created a prototype of the book. So we broke all the conventions in order to be able to get the book published. So we already have this prototype that I'd printed out with the ones that we thought were going to be in there. And when you compare like this, you know, this paper book design that poor Dominic had to learn with the finished version, there are ones that I have to go back and check and go, is that one in the book or was that in the prototype? So there's one which I really like, which didn't make it into the final, this particular book. Who knows whether it'll be in a future edition if one happens, but it's the platypus. So the platypus is very journalistic in terms of it's more used in sort of journalistic technological circles, and it's somebody with multiple capabilities. So they're not just a journalist, they're not just in technology, they do lots and lots of different things. Much like, you know, the platypus, people were a bit confused about what it first was when it was first discovered, as it were. So the platypus sadly didn't make it in, which you know, we're a bit disappointed by it, but we do believe it's something that's going to become even more prominent in conversation. One of the other things that, you know, we have discovered is the ones that we ideas that we looked at, so bearing in mind this project's been going on for like 4 years, so the stag for example, mm-hmm. is in the book, and it's an investor that basically wants to make a quick buck, so he wants to make a quick profit and move on, and it gets in an early stage before a company is listed on the stock market. What's happened now is that we've discovered that the stag is being discussed a lot right now in investment circles, because a lot of people are coming in and trying to get into that sort of mindset of being like, okay, let me make loads of money, let me invest in this and run away again. So in terms of what you're, you know, asking about ones that didn't make it in, there are many, many that didn't make it in, but yet we still have within our spreadsheet of plenty, as we call it. But there are lots that, you know, there's another term that's just come up. It's actually called the wolf warrior, diplomacy, and that's related to China, and that's a really new term. And so again, if we had another edition, it's one I would include, because it's becoming really important when it comes to trade wars. But what we did manage to include is Mongolia and the wolf economy, because Mongolia wants to see itself as the wolf economy, you know, like you've got the tiger economies of actually several different countries, to be perfectly frank with you. But Mongolia, because it has this spiritual relationship with the wolf, I told you I was a bit obsessed with the wolf, you know, people believe that they're descended from a wolf and a doe. That's why, in a way, it wants to use that, because there's already that connection there, but also because it's quite, they see the wolf as very brave. So it goes back to like, what image do people want to do countries, etc., want to portray to the rest of the world. So yeah, lots of ones didn't make it. I'm trying to think of some other ones. You put me on the spot here. This is why the book's really good. I can see the image in my head, and I'm like going to make sure that I get the definition correct. You know, we've got one, I'm sure it's a fish related one. We had several fish related ones, and we were trying to figure, but then there's a lot of fish ones already out there. So that's the other thing. We had to be very careful. Like, there's only so many, you know, elephants that you can have. And so far in the book, we've got elephant hunting, elephant oil fields, white elephant. Do you know what I mean? So,
right,
and
there were far more elephants out there. Yeah, I see what you're saying. You know, there were some, if it was too many of the same kind, you had to sort of, you know, cull them a little bit. Yeah, I totally get that. Now, you know what, what's interesting, as you mentioned the platypus, that just reminded me, and it wasn't in my questions, but I'm just going to mention it. You mentioned the platypus and how it's about knowing many things or doing many things. And that reminded me, back in the day when I was working in the business world, we used to talk about the fox and the hedgehog. And that's from, I don't know if you're familiar with it, but the philosopher Isaiah Berlin, it was one of his most popular essays that he wrote. It's called The Hedgehog and the Fox. And basically it's, you know, in the business world, we would say the fox is somebody who knows many things, but the hedgehog, and they know many things, you know, they know a little bit of everything, but the hedgehog is somebody who knows one big thing. And it's almost, you know, in the business world, we'd say you need both. You need both kinds of people. And so it's funny.
No, but this is the thing. I'm glad you raised it. That one, I found out, as we were going to press, yeah. I discovered that one. I was like, no, why did I forget that one? Because that's the thing. You start, you know, for some it's super obvious. So like if like somebody like you with your background, you know these terms, mm-hmm. and you're like, oh wait, you know, what about this, what about this? So there are so many that you could include. But then for me, someone like me who's just new to the world, as it were, and being like, oh, I've discovered this, it's about making that connection and being able to sort of go from we've got porcupine provision, for example, and mm-hmm. that's linked to like chakra cleanse, but being like, actually, how can I get to the fox and the hedgehog? And you know who's also really good, I mean, because I know you know about folklore and stuff. Aesop and his fables.
Oh yes.
Aesop and his fables. They have had a significant influence in resulting in animals here, there, and everywhere. And it wouldn't surprise me if the fox and the hedgehog also has some sort of link to Aesop. To be perfectly frank.
Oh yeah, I'm pretty sure that Isaiah Berlin got that from those fables for sure. But I mean, he kind of just took it like a whole step further. But yeah, you're right. So you're talking about these, and you know, what you mentioned there was origin stories, right? And you mention in the book, with some of these, you mention the origin stories. And so while I know the terms, I didn't know a lot of these origin stories that I read in your book, and some were really fascinating for me, especially the ones with origins in China, like you were saying earlier. So my question to you is, you know, which ones were the most surprising or shocking for you to discover? You know, like you say, you're not from that world. And so for you, some of this was very new. So if you could give us one or two that were the most surprising or shocking for you in terms of, you know, oh, wow, you know, I'd never have thought that.
Well, this is the thing. It's because I have a background in verification and sort of fact checking. It's being the journalist. So as we were going through it, we were both, Dominic and I were both like, it's all very well that we've got like, here's some cool creatures and we can explain, you know, a shark repellent is this. But ideally, we want to understand how it's come about so we can actually verify it. And we can be like, okay, this came about in this time and this was actually used by this person. And in fact, I'm just going to refer to the book because one of them is actually, I think it's the lame duck. So the lame duck switches between politics and business, as it were. But what I liked about the lame duck is, so I'm just going to read it out because it's my own thing. But a lame duck, it refers to an individual or a company that cannot keep up with the rest of the market. So I think many people can get that they know that, like, oh, if somebody mentions a lame duck, oh yeah, you know, it's slightly problematic. But what's interesting about the origin story is that it was coined in the 18th century at the London Stock Exchange, and it referred to a stockbroker who defaulted on his debts. And then we're like, well, that's quite interesting. But remember I said earlier about the OED, the Oxford English Dictionary, being one of the useful reference points that we went back to again and again. I absolutely loved it when I went back into the citations. And the OED cited the letters of this English writer who I know from studying his Gothic novels. His name is Horace Walpole. And in 1761, his was the first recorded use, where he wrote, "Do you know what a bull and a bear and a lame duck are?" And I'm like, that's so cool, because I never would have thought that Horace Walpole, who writes, you know, who writes about Gothic things and to me is associated with horror world, is actually somebody who wrote about the lame duck and managed to help get it into conversation. That now, you know, if you Google now, you will see it being used on basically a daily basis somewhere, whether it was Donald Trump at some point being described as a lame duck president before he finally sort of left the White House, or, you know, whether it's a country, for example, being described as in a lame duck position. It's something that we use everywhere. But then to learn that, I thought was really, really pretty cool. And then another one would, you know, again, we all grow up, and a lot of us when we're kids have piggy banks. And for me, looking into the history of the piggy banks, and although it's not about investments or anything, at the end of the day, it's potentially your first exposure to savings. And the piggy bank, I thought originally it was just, you know, people saw pigs and that's where it came from, that they ate so much. And it was like, well, no, actually, the piggy bank goes back to, I think it's 1450, and it's the word pig, which I think is spelled P-Y-double-G. I might have to triple check that, by the way, so I apologize if that's wrong. But yeah, it is P-Y-double-G. But this was an earthenware pot that people would put their money in. So it didn't look like a pig. So what happened is, it's the other way around. Actually, when people started fashioning these pots into something, you know, cool to sell, because they had the word pig already, they then designed it so that it looked like the other pig. And I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah. I had no idea about those origin stories that you mentioned with Horace Walpole, or even the pot. They're fascinating. I mean, was there ever a point then when you were doing all this research that you thought, oh, you know, this particular term and its story should be like an entire book by itself? Like I was reading and I thought, you know, turtle trading. Oh, wow. I thought there could be like a whole business thriller on turtle trading, you know? So, I mean, was there ever something that jumped out at you where you thought, oh God, there should be like a whole book on just this one term or something?
I mean, so I think turtle trading has a book itself anyway. The guy's done really well out of it. Yeah, there's only a book on turtle trading. But the others, to be perfectly frank with you, they'd make full-on fat books, but they'd make little mini novellas. They'd make little episodic stints because all we've done, our book, Bear Markets and Beyond, the whole point of it is just to be a primer, just to be an initial, guess what? Here are some creatures. We're not going to give you the full be all and end all, to be perfectly frank with you, because some of them are going to involve things like dragnet clauses and stuff like that, and you're going to have to go and learn those terms in order to be able to then understand. But what we're going to give you is a starter point, much like a children's story or a folk tale, that if it's a term that you particularly enjoy, you can go off and write a whole book about it. You know, you've got like Robert Ward, for example. He came up with the civets, and that's actually quite a recent term, in the fact that when he came up with it, the civets is an acronym that happens when you bundle Colombia, Indonesia, Vietnam, Egypt, Turkey and South Africa together, and everyone thought, okay, you know, these are going to be emerging markets that are ones to really watch. They didn't fully emerge to the extent that everybody thought they were going to, but again, you could create a whole, well, Robert could create a whole book out of the fact that, well, actually what happened to the civets? I thought they were going to be this huge thing. And then the other thing is, you can get all these cool little facts about civets and stuff, you know, that this small nocturnal mammal found in Asia and Africa. So you've got like a double hit, and that's why I love it so much and why I'm still passionate about it, even though it is business and I have been talking about it for a while, because you learn something new each time. And that's the cool thing, you know, you learn something cool about the animal. Like civets, by the way, they're the ones that are linked to coffee. I don't drink coffee because I get too hyper, but you know what I mean? They're the ones that are linked to coffee, where people would drink the coffee made from the beans that would pass through their bottoms. But then there's a whole
thing. Oh, I heard about that somewhere. I read about that somewhere. Yeah.
But then there's that whole thing about whether that's ethical or not. So you've got, you know, the minute you start, then end up in that rabbit hole doesn't stop, I'm telling you. So you've got to figure out what point do you need to chapter end, as it were. And I find it hard because, you know, I have to be like, stop. Yeah. You know, like the black swan, for example, many people know what a black swan is now. Right. And when we started looking into it, this didn't make it into the book so much, but even then, Nassim Nicholas Taleb, but he's the one who came up with it. No, he didn't actually come up with it. He's the one who popularized it as a concept that, you know, black swan events are outlier events that, you know, in hindsight, people can add explanations to. And everybody talks about that nowadays. Mm-hmm. So when you actually look at the term black swan itself, and he does refer to it, it's aeons old. It's like so ancient that it goes back to, like, you know, you are literally looking back in history as to why do people think that black swans are rare? Are they actually rare? Where are swans used elsewhere in terms of different languages in terms of how unusual they are? So, you know, this is the point. I'm now going to start going completely off tangents. I'm like, where am I myself in? But, you know what I mean, it's I like it because,
well, it's also, I think it's about language, right? I think that's one of the reasons, you know, that to your point, there's all these stories, but it's also about how we use language and how we use terms to mean multiple things. Now, and speaking of that, these terms, some of these, you know, that you've described in the book, they're influenced by or have been coined on social media, which means they're fairly recent, right? But it takes, it takes a certain something for a term to go viral and then to stick. So, you know, some of those social media related terms, like, you know, vomiting camel and milkshake duck, can you, like, in your mind, how, like, as you were reading up on these and learning about how they went viral, how they stuck, and became part of this business lexicon. How did that make you think about or view social media differently in terms of how, you know, certain terms are invented and then stick because of social media?
No, because in my day job, for many, many years, I've been on the social beat. So it's sort of, somewhere that I'm very, very much immersed in terms of how stories originate from social, the psychology of it, why people post on social and what they do behind it. So to be perfectly frank with you, I was in very natural territory here in terms of taking one part of my life and applying it. So when with the Milkshake Duck, that had been around for not that long ago, but still still in social times, because everything's so fast paced, it had actually been around for quite a while, if that makes sense. So
yeah.
In times, not that long, but in social times, quite
long. Yeah, because things move so quickly on social media, right? Which is the next news cycle. So I hear what you're saying, yeah.
But you're right about it sticking. Yeah. But the thing is, it's something that kept coming up. And in fact, I think with the Milkshake Duck at one point, you know, they were looking to make it, whether it was Word of the Year or there were discussions about at what point does it enter the dictionary? So I thought, okay, fair enough. If they're now those discussions that even the various dictionaries are admitting in blogs that they're keeping an eye on these terms, then there's something for us to definitely be aware of in terms of with the book. We didn't want it to date. We wanted it to be something that you could go back to again and again. And so with the Milkshake Duck, we had significant confidence that this was a term that was now cemented enough in social parlance that people would want to know what it was if they weren't already aware of it. And the other thing that's happening, I mean, for those who don't know, you know, a Milkshake Duck, it's an internet, it refers to like this internet meme. So it stands for somebody who has like all this popularity, is like the flavor of the moment, it's a milkshake. And then there's all this like revelation that you know, they've got loads of flaws. And so all that being famous and being amazing or whatever, it makes it really problematic. And then we hear a lot now about cancel culture, which in itself is, to be honest, a whole other ball game, and is being used in very, very different ways. But if you're going to be talking about cancel culture, then you're going to need to know what a milkshake duck is. And so I'm super glad that we managed to get the milkshake duck in. Mm-hmm. And we did have a conversation with our editors about, you know, so basically we had some conversations with our editors too, because again, it goes back to what do we include, what do we not include? And also, is a milkshake duck businessy enough to be included in a business bestiary? And my justification for it was, well, yes, it is, because people have lost their jobs after becoming a milkshake ducks, a duck even. So, you know, they become super famous and then people have gone through their social media history. And then it's been like, actually, no, you can't work here anymore. You know, you don't fit in with the ethos of our company, even though they might have said something, you know, as a teenage mistake, for example. So I think it's something that people should definitely be aware of. And then again, the vomiting camel, I'm pretty sure Dominic spotted that one and flagged it out to me. So again, way before we had the book deal. And that one we thought was really important to include, because people talk a lot about fake news at the moment and disinformation and misinformation. So for me, coming from that background and having had that background for many, many years, in terms of debunking, I thought it was important, because the vomiting camel is a lesson in not believing everything that you see on the internet. And, you know, it emerged back in 2014, and it was an analyst who her colleague had spotted this weird pattern on the RDX, which is the Russian Depository Index chart, and then just, you know, drew a vomiting camel. She put it out on the internet, and then it started to get a life of its own. And Katie Martin, who works for the Financial Times, picked that up and was always saying, this is a joke. I would be saying, oh, look, here's a vomiting camel formation. Oh, look, here's a vomiting camel formation. But it was always a joke. But then some people didn't realize it was a joke. And so you'd see this poor vomiting camel sometimes appear in real life, like people going, oh, yes, this means this. And you're like, what are you on about? You're literally making it up. It doesn't mean anything. It doesn't exist. The vomiting camel formation, so, you know, on a chart, it's like all these lines or whatever, which people deduce looks like a vomiting camel. It doesn't mean anything at all. It does not exist. It was started as an observation, in terms of, oh, look, you know, you can make something out of nothing, and just people went with it, because sometimes you've got to have fun in business, as we've discovered.
Yes. Right. So. Right. Well, and so speaking of fun, let me ask you this. if you had to pick maybe one or two of your personal favorites from all of these, which would they be?
So I'm not going to obsess about the wolves, but the wolves are definitely in there. But apart from that, I really like the grey rhinos. And I actually now become quite friendly with Michelle Wooker, who came up with the concept. So she came up with the concept in response to the black swans, which were everywhere. And the reason why I really like the grey rhinos right now is because so many people are discussing them, especially in light of the pandemic. So at some point, some people were like, is the coronavirus pandemic a black swan event in that it's just basically turned up out of nowhere, but we're going to be able to look back in hindsight? Or is it a grey rhino in the fact there are many, many signals there? So it's like this huge object that's charging your way with its, you know, big horn and everything that you need to be aware of. You know, is it something you're just going to ignore even though it's coming up in your face? Or are you actually going to take heed of the fact you've got a massive grey rhino coming up in your face? And that's the thing, many people are saying with the pandemic there were plentiful signals that something was going to be happening, and the question was whether we prepared for it or not. So I think the grey rhino is very, very fascinating, and I think a lot of other people are taking that concept too. The grey rhino has really taken off in China, and it's, you know, part of the Chinese government financial strategies too, and that came from Michelle having an idea and sticking with it. So I think it is definitely one of my favorites. And I like the image that you know, Dominic's drawn in the book, where you've got this like big gray lumbering beast just at you. It is what it says on the tin, as it were. So right. I like that.
Yeah. And you know, you mentioned how, I mean, with the pandemic, I mean, I think that's a very good example of how this term is so relevant for us today. You know, we had all the signs, we had all the visible you know, markers of, okay, this is going to be a huge problem. It's going to be a huge problem. And then, like you say in the description for this term, then things started to move fast, trampling everything in their wake, right? And that's kind of what happened with this pandemic. So, yeah, very apt term.
And another one I really like is also hamsterkauf. It is one of my favorites, and it's partly because it became a little bit famous as a meme, and it's a word that just emerged in the, again, no, that's a lie, it didn't just, so people think it emerged in the pandemic. So this one was our last image and our last definition that we put in before it went to press, as it were. And what I love about the image is that it's a hamster in a shopping basket eating like loads of toilet paper rolls. But it means I've only discovered this actually very recently, so this bit's not even in the book, so you're getting some fresh information. It goes back to World War II, the term. So it's been around for a very long time, and it means hamster purchase. So the fact you've got this German term, again, seeing a peak because of the pandemic, because people are like, what is going on with all this stockpiling? I really like that as well. So it's, again, taking terms that have been around for quite a while, but resonating, and are able to be applied in current times. And that's why it's so fun.
I mean, I've used the term, you know, I've used, I'm not hamster calf because I've not used the German term, but you know, in terms of hoarding like a hamster, I've used that as a simile. So yeah, that's interesting, but you're right.
Squirrel. I haven't got squirrel in the book, but people say to squirrel something away.
I mean, what's amazing is how relevant a lot of these are, and sometimes how we use them in daily, everyday language without even realizing, right, the origin or the context or the background where it first came from.
Exactly. But that's the thing, you know, how can you be sad when you're talking about animals? You can't. Yeah, so that's why I like it.
Yeah.
You know, how can it be dry when you're talking about creatures? You can't.
Right.
Creatures. And some of them aren't, you know, I mean, they aren't real, but they've clearly taken on a life of their own. You know, we did talk about the unicorn, we did talk about the dragon. So these are the creatures that are in the original bestiary, you know, the medieval bestiary, and yet now they've got completely different definitions.
Right. So let me ask you then, what's next for you after all this book launch stuff is behind you? Are you working on another book? Is it at a stage where you could talk about it?
I was going to say sleep. I honestly
I hear you.
At the moment, I'm completely immersed in the world of animals and still sort of doing a lot more with them, because this is something I actually have to learn in terms of having boundaries with the fact that at some point it is going to have to stop. Mm-hmm. But we keep finding new creatures. So the spreadsheet the spreadsheet of plenty is still spreadsheeting of plenty, as it were. But no, I do need to take a step back. It's been interesting. And you know, I know that you know you've had sort of your book. In fact, I've got a copy of the translation books with Ratna Dolly. It was brilliant, absolutely amazing. Cool. Thank you. Yeah. You know, I've got it next to me right now. But it's that whole sort of taking a breather, getting out of this mode. The fact that we've been doing this while the pandemic's been going on, and having a book out in lockdown has been a particularly strange experience, because you don't get to have, you know, I've not seen it in a bookshop, which is a bit sad. I didn't get to have a proper book launch, as it were.
Yeah.
So I'd quite like to have those experiences and be like, okay, well, that's complete, and I've done everything I can with spreading the word about the book. And you know, I'm super pleased, like today I discovered that it was in another primary school, so a small person school. And you know, it's in university reading list and stuff, so you know, it's been shortlisted for an award. So
that's great. Congrats. Yeah,
thank you. Well, considering it came, you know, some people are like, this is such a dumb idea, I'm super pleased that I pursued it, because I knew it would make a difference. So it's been a real resilience booster and a real confidence booster. But it is like, I do think that when you've invested so much in a project, that in order for your brain to be able to think differently again, that I'll probably have to take a bit of a break from anything animal related, animal business related at least, and then just let my brain have a rest and whatever's been mulling in the background that I've just not been aware of because of pandemic and having to actually, you know, working and doing care stuff at home and having the book and stuff. I'm hoping that my brain is going to be like, okay, have some time off, and now this is all the ingredients that have been going on that you don't know about, and here's the next idea, and maybe this could be a book, or this could be some other innovative project that will keep you going. I always just like challenges, something different, just to keep the brain going.
Right. No, and I hear you about needing a break. I think, you know, launching a book during a pandemic, as you said, I've been through it, and it's exhausting and it's weird. And yeah, taking a break to just let things settle, there's no harm in that at all. So my last question is kind of sort of related to that, which is, and I ask everybody this, which is, what's your favorite Desi book and why?
Oh, that is a good question. Well, at the moment, yours is, so it's a bit annoying, actually.
Yeah. Well, no, I'm very happy to hear you say that. Well, it's not, it's a translation, so it's Dunkate, though. It's the original writer. Yeah.
Even though I'm a Gujie, I didn't know. And I spoke to my mum about this, and I was like, who's this and what's going on? So my parents are Kenyan, Indian, but Kenyan in origin. And there are loads of things that we don't know either, because I think things get sort of mishmashed up. And right now, yeah, I've been waxing lyrical about the translations, to be honest, and the stories and the I know you've said it's one of the more famous ones, but this story about the post office. Yeah. And it's about connections. And for me, right now, where it's been super difficult to make connections and it's involved so much more effort, I found it really has resonated. So yeah, right now you're in my good books, because you've given me my current sort of favorite Desi book, as it were.
Great. Well, no, that's great. And you know, I love when people read in translation, because I always say that the best South Asian literature is not written in English. The best South Asian literature tends to be in non-English languages, and we need to have more translators to bring them to us, because obviously we can't read that many languages. Nobody can. You know, I only read one or two, you know, so for me to read something from Tamil or you know, Bengali, I need somebody to translate it for me, because there are amazing stories out there. And yeah, I think it just, there's so much diversity in just one country, right?
it really is. I mean, this is a bit of a cliche, to be honest, but it is a melting pot, and that's what you need to have access to. And by having access to that, it helps you belong a lot more, I think, because you're like, okay, this is what I love about reading, and I know it sounds very basic in that respect, but it is whole other worlds, and it is about finding answers when you're not able to find answers in that which is around you. And that's where reading is so magical, and being able to go through into heritage, into history, because that's what you're doing at the end of the day.
Yeah, and you know, I heard you on that podcast that you had shared when you mentioned this book, and mm-hmm. you would be amazed through the, and I'm digressing a little bit, but you'd be amazed at how many people have read the Dhoomketu translation and said to me that this was a way for them to reconnect with their Gujarati culture. Mm. Even though some of the stories are almost 100 years old, and some, you know, they're reading it not in Gujarati, they're reading it in English, but there are aspects, and I tried to make sure I was keeping some of the Gujarati-ness in there. But, you know, it's a way, one of the reasons that I ended up doing translation was I wanted to see people like myself, and I wasn't seeing them, right? I mean, when I say myself, our culture, I just want our heritage. And even though we're not people like the people in these stories, right? We're living in the 21st century. We're not living in the 19th or the 20th century, but there's still something there that helps you connect. And I thought that it's resonated. The book has done well, I think, because there aren't a lot of Gujarati translation works to begin with. And so this kind of filled a gap in the market. And then, you know, people like yourself who kind of have that disconnect because you weren't born in India, you haven't lived there, and that this is one way for you to, you know, connect with your ancestors.
To be like, okay, this is in a way why I'm a little bit what I am, because it's sort of in, you know, we're inherited. And I think that's super special and super amazing. And you said about, you know, people like us not being there. One of the reasons I think maybe I was so Rottweiler-like about this book, and I think it's super important, is that growing up, you don't, like your name, my name, we don't have our names on books in Western libraries. Mm-hmm. We don't, you know? And that's not a bad thing in terms of, like, you know, I had access to amazing books, et cetera, et cetera. But I never saw a Shah, like, on a book when I was growing up. And this book, because it's for kids as well as adults, I was ready to give up at points, if I'm perfectly frank with you. I was tired, I was exhausted, I was like, nobody wants this book, you know. I can't get an agent, I can't do this in a conventional way, I don't understand it. But my nephew, so again, you know, another generation down, he was like, every time I went to go and see him, have you tried this publisher? Have you tried this children's publisher? Have you tried this? Oh, I can't wait to have my name in a book because he's going to be in the acknowledgements. So, like, oh. But you know what I mean? It's like, can you try this? Can you try that? And for me, it was like, it's important for me to have got to the point of exhaustion with making sure that I've tried to get this published, because this child is very young and he's interested in business.
Yeah.
He's, you know, he's under 10 years old and he's interested in business. His, you know, he's encouraged his sister, who's even younger, to now be interested in business. And they will sit there and they have sat there and they have read this book, like, not even just for their names, but because of the fact that, you know, they'll be like, they can tell you that how a bear market operates from the words that are used. So the things that they understand, they can tell you what the images are like, and they have also gone off and done their own thing. And they're not the only kids who have done that. I've seen so many kids from different cultures doing it. And I'm like, that's why people like you and I do this, even though it's blimmin' difficult and it's hard and people don't want to hear it, you know, or, you know, who are you writing for? What's it for? Mm-hmm. It's for everybody. You know why? Because that's how we have to cope. We can't just be for a minority. We can't just be for this audience, because we have to assimilate. We have to be chameleon-like, as I use the animals. We have to move between so many different identities. Mm-hmm. So it's unsurprising that your books are beyond Desi Reads, as they were, to be perfectly frank with you. Right. It's unsurprising that my book is very, there's nothing like it on the market, because we spend so long probably trying not to be pigeonholed. Again, sorry for the unintentional puns here, but it happens. And I think that is super key for people who are entering this world of publishing, etc., etc., or doing any project, actually, not even just publishing, that we have to be capable of doing so much more so that others behind us feel that they can also do it,
right?
You know, without being all sort of idealistic, but I just think it's super important.
Yeah, I always said, you know, when it's one thing to clear a path for ourselves, but we have to make sure we're clearing that path for the folks who are coming up behind us, right? And I, you know, I think that there is an entire generation of South Asian writers, quite frankly, before us, who didn't do that, And that's why it's been harder for us, because you think it wouldn't be that hard, but it has been harder because there was a generation before us who did not necessarily do what you just said, which is, you know, hey, look, I got to clear this path behind me. There are people coming up behind me as well, and I want to make sure they have a fair chance as well. So I hear you, and that's an excellent, excellent note, positive note for us to end on. And so I want to thank you, first of all, again, for, you know, this conversation, this terrific book. As you say, it's just a very powerful book, and even though it's a small, compact thing, but it's a powerful book in terms of what it does and what it represents in the market, in the industry. So thank you for that, and congrats again on the shortlist. And I look forward to the book launch in the US, and we'll be cheering you on.
You've been listening to episode 44 of Desi Books, news and views about Desi literature from the world over. I'm your host, Jenny Butt. Thank you for tuning in. Today's episode was a Desi Craft Chat Rewind. This is a new feature that will run from time to time when writers featured on Desi Books are back in the news for their terrific work. So this week, we had Truti Shah, who had been interviewed on episode 26 in April 2021 for her award-winning book, Bear Markets and Beyond, A Bestiary of Business Terms. Episode 45 will be up shortly. Follow on Twitter at Desi Books, Instagram at Desi.books, Facebook at Desi Books FB, and tag the accounts if you have requests or suggestions. You can also sign up for the free weekly newsletter on the Desi Books website. That's desibooks.co. Stay healthy, keep reading, and write well.